From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week when Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos made an announcement that the online retailer plans to acquire Whole Foods for about $3.7 billion. That proposed deal would give Amazon a brick-and-mortar presence in Whole Foods' 431 stores nationwide, and it inspired a slew of commentary about how the world is now changing. Critics call Bezos a tech monopolist and say that the mega merger is dangerous for shoppers and dangerous because of political and corporate concentrated power. Others say the deal is not only not a concern, but that Whole Foods will benefit from the merger and that the grocery industry could remain competitive. But how will all of this impact you? What's really realistic here for consumers? And how does the deal affect employees, wages as well? Our guests have some differing views on this, and we're going to have a conversation with our guest in studio, the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT, Amit Bhatia-Biyal. Professor Bhatia-Biyal, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line with us is Matt Stoller, a fellow at the Open Markets Program of the New America Foundation. Matt, welcome to you as well. We got Matt somewhere. We'll find him in a second. Amit, let me start with you. You wrote a piece recently for the Rochester Business Journal called "Are Mergers Good for Consumers?" And I want to start with what you talk to your students about. You say, when I ask my students what they think about mergers, they frequently reply that mergers between firms in an industry may be good for the firms, but they are bad for consumers. And they gave you a few reasons. Why did they say that?
Well, typically the belief is, or at least this is what they've come to believe, that when two firms merge, the primary interest of their mind is maximizing profits. And when they maximize profits, they're not necessarily acting in the welfare of consumers. Consumers sort of come along for the ride, particularly if the firms have some kind of market power. So that is basically what they think, that, you know, it's all about profit maximization, possibly at the expense of consumer welfare.
And are they wrong?
It depends. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. This is, you know, one of those cases where a one-size-fits-all policy just doesn't work. And from an antitrust perspective, you very much have to look at the specifics of the individual merger to determine whether or not it's a desirable thing for consumers in general.
All right. So before I turn over to Matt here, what are your thoughts? What was your initial reaction to seeing Amazon and Whole Foods?
Wow. That was my initial reaction. Just to correct a figure, they bought Whole Foods for $13.7 billion, not $3.7 billion.
Did I say three? Okay.
Yeah, thanks. So it's the single largest acquisition that Amazon has ever made. It beats the next acquisition, which I think was about $1 billion or maybe $1.5 billion. And it gives them cachet in a way that will be very interesting to see what they do, not only with the acquisition, but what happens to the whole group of Whole Foods shoppers who thus far have been pretty eager shoppers and pretty loyal customers of Whole Foods markets.
All right, Matt Stoller, your piece for Huffington Post was called "America's Amazon Problem." And you hit that as a problem from a couple of angles, but let's start with what you think about consumers. You write this in your piece for Huffington Post, quote, "Our communities and the way we engage in commerce will change. Imagine walking into a Whole Foods store and seeing different prices depending on whether you are a member of Amazon Prime or seeing different prices depending on any other way that you interact with Amazon," end quote. You think that's realistic?
I do. It's pretty clear that Amazon uses its power to discriminate, price discriminate, and drive competitors out of business, drive down supplier prices, cut jobs. But what the real problem with Amazon is not about consumers, because consumers may or may not benefit. The real problem is that Amazon is at this point a threat to a democracy. It's a threat to communities, a threat to small businesses. And it is Jeff Bezos' goal to basically take a cut of every piece of commerce in America, pick winners and losers, and really just change our society in some fundamentally scary ways.
So why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you think about the political concentration of power here? You write in your piece that when Bezos calls you irresponsible for not tithing to Amazon, America has a big political problem. Tell me more about that.
So in 2010, there was a guy who started a company. I started it in 2005 called Diapers.com, and it was intended to be the most family-friendly company out there, to the specific way of selling products to young parents and to parents. And they figured out a way of actually getting products to parents that was very helpful. In 2010, Jeff Bezos threatened them and said, if you don't sell out to us, we are going to price diapers at zero to destroy your margin. And so they eventually did sell out to Amazon for cheap. Now, that might not sound like a big deal. Diapers prices are now back to what they were, at least Amazon took the discounts away that they were using to threaten diapers.com. That may not sound like a big deal, although I think it is. But it is a what they're doing is they're undermining the ability of you and me, of every person in this country, to start a business. Because Jeff Bezos has made it clear that he will use any means at his disposal to undermine anybody who might sell products through his network or compete with his network in a way that he does not approve of. And that's really dangerous. It is really dangerous to have one guy controlling the entire retail infrastructure of the United States.
You also wrote that Bezos is essentially acting in a political way. He looks like a political operator from your view, yes?
Yeah, I mean, look, Amazon's one of the biggest lobbyists in D.C. They are constantly hiring important political fixers like Ivanka Trump's lawyer, Jamie Gorelick. She's now on the board. They are a political institution. They hired the former head of antitrust for DOJ in the Bush administration and the former head of antitrust in the Obama administration. They put the new head of Whole Foods is a private equity executive who is the wife of the publisher of the New York Times. This is a very politically connected institution. The day before, Jeff Bezos offers a massive philanthropy endeavor. I mean, these guys are not operating like a business. These guys are operating like political lords, and this is very dangerous.
All right, Professor Badabial, do you disagree on any of those points?
Well, I disagree with
Go ahead.
I disagree with most of them. It is true that Amazon is in the business of altering consumer tastes and consumer preferences. And it's succeeding in a way, at least in some areas, with, say, membership in Prime. But to suggest that, you know, it is a behemoth and that we should be worrying about it because concentration of power, either economic or political, is so vast is, I think, largely overblown. Including the Whole Foods purchase, Amazon's market share in grocery, the grocery market in general, is less than 2%. So if we are terrified about Amazon, we should be even more terrified about Walmart, which has about 16 to 18% of the grocery market. So why not you know, raise a scaremongering alarm about Walmart too, which has 9 or 10 times the market concentration of Amazon? But I don't see any similar crying about Walmart.
Okay, Matt.
Well, look, I mean, oh, it's just 1% of the grocery market. It's not a big deal. You know, you hear this constantly, but it was a big deal to Wall Street. I mean, Walmart stock went down by 5%. Target stock went down 10%, and Amazon stock went up upon the announcement of the acquisition of Whole Foods. This is extremely rare to have an acquiring company's stock go up. By the way, Target is not actually a significant a grocery store in terms of their revenue. So everybody who has money on the line recognizes this is not about the grocery market. This is about control of the entire grocery and retail infrastructure in the entire country. And if you think that that's okay to have that controlled by one person, then, you know, all right, I can have that argument. But to pretend like, oh, it's not a particularly big deal and that's not actually the debate, that's just kind of bad faith.
Ahmed?
Well, let me disagree stringently, because most of what he's saying is conjecture right now. And the fact of the matter is,
Did the Wall Street shares move as I suggested they did?
Well,
after
Donald Trump won, Wall Street shares went up by a huge margin. So what does that suggest? That Trump is some magical person?
That Walmart stock dropping by 5% and Target stock dropping by 10% and Kroger stock dropping by 16% on Friday after Amazon made this announcement had nothing to do at all with the Whole Foods announcement. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that was the initial reaction. What happened after that?
Analogized what I was saying to the stock market going up as if it had been going up under Trump. So either acknowledge that this is a big deal and this is going to change things in a fundamental way, or just say that it's not. But you can't have it both ways.
I'm not having it both ways. How many stories have you written crying about Walmart?
I mean, I've written a bunch, but I don't see what that has to do with anything. I think Walmart.
It has everything to do with everything. You're very concerned about Amazon, which has less than 1/50th the market share of groceries. And Walmart has 16%.
It's not a big deal, except that the stock prices show that it is a big deal. Everybody knows that this is a big deal. So let's have the debate. And yeah, Walmart has absolutely too much power. That's why, you know, we know what happens when Walmart moves into town. Obesity rates go up. Voting rates drop. This is a bad thing. To have the retail power concentrated. Now, what we're talking about with Amazon is actually so much more concentration than we've ever seen. So, yeah, Walmart is a problem. Amazon is that problem times 100. All right, but so, let's be honest about what we're debating here.
All right, so let me just back up for a second and say that our guest on the phone, Matt Stoller, has written about mergers and antitrust and monopoly power, not only for quite a while, but really prominently since just before the election. He wrote a piece called How Democrats Killed Their Populist Soul that ended up being sort of a pre-mortem in this election for The Atlantic. And so, Matt, why don't you kind of step back a little and instead of just looking at Whole Foods, kind of let our listeners know about your concern about I know it doesn't sound sexy to listeners, but this is it's an important kind of part of the national conversation right now about concentration of corporate power, antitrust, et cetera. And then we'll see what Professor Badabiel says about that. But kind of back up and put this in the larger context for us, Matt.
Well, look, I mean, we see it all over the place, right? I mean, when United Airlines, you know, can beat up a passenger or have them dragged off a plane, when, you know, when there are no regional airlines anymore and they are cutting service, so it's hard to get around this country. Same thing is happening with trains. When people have virtually no choice with their broadband provider, one search engine, one social network, a concentration all across the board in terms of everything from mattresses to glasses to pharmaceuticals, hospitals. We are, as Americans, as workers, as small business people, increasingly being guided and controlled and managed by a small group of people, which includes Jeff Bezos, but extends, you know, to Wall Street and to a couple of others like Eric Schmidt at Google. And that is a threat to our way of life. It is a threat to our democracy, and it is a threat to who we are as Americans. And it's time to start talking about this. For 60 years, I mean, basically what I wrote was for 60 years, from the Great Depression until the 1970s, 90s, you could sort of date it in multiple different ways. The Democrats were the party that said that monopoly power was a threat to our liberties. It was a threat to our way of life. And that the Democratic Party was going to be the institutional vehicle for the people themselves to constrain concentrated power. And the Reagan administration at first and then the Clinton administration got rid of that way of managing our economy. And so now what we've seen, first we saw the financial crisis with, you know, too big to fail, the relaxation of things like Glass-Steagall, relaxation of media ownership limits, and so on and so forth. We've seen a concentration of power in the hands of a small group of people, and that means both regional inequality, political inequality, political corruption, instability, lower productivity, lower small business growth, a whole series of significant political and economic problems that we are now wrestling with. And it's time for us to start recognizing this and start addressing it once again, as we did successfully for many, many years.
All right. So, Professor Badabiel, from your perspective on the history there, you know, is there anywhere you disagree on sort of the framing of how history unfolded there and then some of the causes?
Well, some of those points are definitely valid. There's no question about that. But let me backtrack and give a little bit of history of my own as far as the economics is concerned before we come back to what he just said. In this country, we have decided that as far as our economic structuring is concerned, we have embraced, for better or for worse, the capitalist system where the free enterprise system is the centerpiece of that system. In this particular system, the job of firms is to maximize profits. Their raison d'etre, they exist to maximize profits. If we have a problem with firms behaving in a way that's consistent with the maximization of profits, maybe we as a body should say something about that. But we can't say that, okay, the free enterprise system is what it's all about, and we understand the business of firms is to maximize profits. And then when they do or undertake actions that are consistent with the maximization of profits, say, oh, here are the following 10 things that are wrong with this particular way of maximizing profits. We want you to maximize profits, but subject to constraints A through Z.
But isn't that just what regulation is?
Regulation is a selective approach to the looking at the behavior of firms when there is evidence to suggest that consumer welfare is being inimically affected by the behavior of firms. So, for instance, if we look at the airline industry, I would be absolutely opposed to a merger between, say, Delta and United or American and United. We basically have three big airlines in the country right now. So a merger between any one of those two, I would significantly oppose. There's no question about that, because that would give a significant amount of concentration to the merged entity in a way that they could really take into consideration their own interests first and, you know, run roughshod over consumer interests, no question. So I am not suggesting that all the regulators should be sent home and that there's nothing for them to do. But then we have to be careful about when we intervene in the market, and we have to make a tangible case that our intervention will solve more problems than it will create.
All right, before I take phone calls, and I'm going to let Matt respond to some of this as well, let me just follow up with Professor Badabiel then. If you would oppose a merger in the airline industry,
right,
where do you draw that line in other industries? How do you draw it?
Well, a key determinant, but not the only determinant, is data about the extent of concentration in a particular industry. So that is one of the key things that I would look at. And along with that, of course, I would look at the history of practices when it comes to pricing, interaction with supply chains, how they're interacting with their workers. Mind you, Whole Foods workers aren't unionized. So those are the things that I would look at. But a key determinant is the extent of concentration in whatever industry that is I'm concerned about.
Okay. Matt Stoller, you want to respond to that? Go ahead.
Well, yeah. I mean, I thought you made some excellent points. And I would just note that the reason that we don't allow extensive concentration, or at least traditionally haven't, is because we do believe in free enterprise. We believe that people have the right to compete, to sell their labor, to start businesses, and monopolies don't allow that. Monopolies are not markets. This is not a liberal thing or a conservative thing. Friedrich Hayek talked in The Road to Serfdom, which was kind of the Bible for the conservative movement. He had an entire chapter about monopolies and the threat that they posed. The British East Indies Company in 1773, the Boston Tea Party, was largely a move against a British multinational monopoly. It's not that we are against free enterprise. I am for free enterprise. A monopoly is not free enterprise. Jeff Bezos controlling the entire retail structure in this country, determining what prices are based on his own desires, as opposed to a market of buyers and sellers, that is not free enterprise. That is dangerous. As for the notion of firms, their job being to maximize shareholder profit, that is a specific intellectual movement that was organized in the 1970s. It is actually pretty new, and it is not consistent with the bulk of the American tradition. We would charter banks and we would charter corporations as political charters to allow individuals to organize resources for particular purposes. But the notion that you would just have firms and their only goal was to maximize profits, that's just not true. It's kind of fake history, and it's why as we manage our corporations the way we have, we see such political instability.
Okay, Amit?
Well, of course, I would disagree with that reading of history. It's not only flawed, it's altogether perplexing to comprehend. But let me take some points, particularly the monopoly point, because he seems to be focused very much on monopoly. Monopoly is a particular industry structure in a free enterprise system, of which there are many. Other examples are oligopoly, monopolistic competition, perfect competition. We have all kinds of scenarios in industries. But there are certain arguments that one can make why monopoly should be tolerated but subject to regulation. But before I come to that, let's consider in the airline industry, because we were just talking about it, Boeing. Boeing is close to a monopoly. It is the only civilian aircraft manufacturer of any repute or size in the United States. But we tolerate Boeing. I don't hear too many noises being made about Boeing and that Boeing should be broken down because it's a terrible threat to our way of life and our democracy. Because people understand that there is a concept known as economies of scale, where under some circumstances, it makes sense for a firm to operate on a very large scale, because when it does so, that's when the cost per unit of production is the cheapest. And when that happens, consumers stand to benefit. Even looking apart from Boeing, there are other entities in life, for instance. Now, entities like UPS and FedEx have destroyed this, but until recently, we had a single USPS, Postal Service. We had one. That's a monopoly. We have one army. We have one defense forces. That's a monopoly. Why do we have those things? Because there is the understanding that the most efficient way to provide a certain set of services is to have a monopoly operate and provide those services, but of course subject to regulation. But to suggest that, you know, Jeff Bezos and this acquisition of Whole Foods is going to destroy our way of life is nonsense.
All right, Matt, one response there, and then I got to get to your phone calls. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, look, I mean, Boeing was created politically in the 1990s. By the Clinton administration encouraging a merger of Boeing with McDonnell Douglas. I mean, the idea that it's a natural monopoly is absurd. It's a function of a political merger, and Boeing is routinely shedding jobs and routinely moving its technology to China. It's a disaster, and it's completely irresponsible the way that we've been managing the ability of our culture to fly. I mean, that's crazy. To hold up Boeing as some sort of example of virtue. I will note that I do agree that there are important natural monopolies. I'd say UPS and FedEx, for example, are subject to common carriage regulation, which is a form of monopoly regulation. There are a whole host of others, like, for example, in the phone system, if I call you, you know, AT&T, back when it was the only network out there, was not allowed to block me from calling you. There were certain rules and regulations. That is actually the case with network monopolies. We need to allow for network effects and actually regulate them effectively or have them run in a public manner like the post office. Electric utilities would fall under that as well. I mean, there was a specific political framework that we used to handle economies of scale and to handle network economies. And it worked really well for, you know, 40 to 60 years. And the fact that we stopped even thinking about it and wrote this entire fake story about the free enterprise system is why things are so bad right now.
All right, so listeners, if you're on the line and our phones are loaded, we're going to spend our second half hour working through your comments and questions for our guests. You're hearing Matt Stoller, a fellow at the Open Markets Program of the New America Foundation, on the line with us, and Professor Amit Badabiel, the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. One written question and then phone calls the rest of the way here. Alan writes to us and says, Evan, just to be sure, how do we actually do this? If we're not happy with the Amazon-Whole Foods merger, is there a mechanism in place already that can prevent it? That's a great question, Alan. I'll start with you, Matt, because I know you've written about this, and we'll let both of you guys weigh in on that. So let's just say that the power holders in this country said, no, we don't want this. Is there a mechanism in place as is to stop it, Matt?
Yeah, the Clayton Act was passed in 1913 or 14, when we had a similar concentration problem. It's an anti-merger statute. And it says that anytime you see substantial lessening of competition, the Federal Trade Commission or the Department of Justice can block a merger. State attorneys generals can also weigh in to block a merger. So this merger, that's technically how you could block it.
Are you aware of anybody in government who has spoken up in favor of using that mechanism, Matt?
There's one congressman, ironically from Silicon Valley. His name is Ro Khanna, and he has said that he's concerned about the effect on jobs and small business and suppliers, and he's called for it to be blocked.
Professor Badabiel, is this a proper way to use this kind of a mechanism? And do you think, broadly speaking, then, should we see any more use of it? I mean, are we sort of ignoring this mechanism now?
I think we're largely ignoring it. But as a voter and as a citizen, if you're concerned about something like this, I think the most normal and even useful channel would be to lobby your congresspersons and senators and ask them to lobby the Department of Justice, because they first and foremost have the power to block a merger of this sort. But I bet the Department of Justice is not going to look at it, because there isn't really nothing to look at so far. Things may change, of course, in the future. But as of right now, with under 2% of the concentration, I don't think there's anything to look at. But I think a more interesting thing is Walmart might come back and make a higher offer for Whole Foods. That, I think, is definitely a possibility. But we have to wait and see what happens.
All right. Both of our guests have written about mergers recently. Last month for the Rochester Business Journal, "Are Mergers Good for Consumers?" We'll post that piece for you online. Matt Stoller, writing for Huffington Post, wrote about America's Amazon problem. And let's get that only break of the hour. We're going to come back to your phone calls next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, new research shows that Republicans think Democrats are dishonest and morally corrupted. Oh, but Democrats, turns out you think the same about Republicans. It is just remarkable what we think about our political opposites and how rarely we have friends who disagree anymore. Well, we're bringing on a panel of friends who are political opposites, proving it can still be done, talking about the value of hearing other opinions. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get to your phone calls. We're talking about the potential Amazon-Whole Foods merger and mergers in general. Chris in Pittsford, first up on the phone. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I do want to say that I'm very much against the Amazon-Whole Foods acquisition merger. And I will say this, that I think starting in the 80s, if my memory is correct, there was a gutting of over many years, and Clinton might have been partly responsible for the antitrust division of the Department of Justice. You see this through giant media mergers, giant healthcare mergers, in food, in retail especially. So I don't see how giant mergers that benefit those with golden parachutes and some stockholders, I don't see how that benefits the general population. To me, it drives down wages, because you have a strangulation of competition where the big boys and the big corporations, the multinationals, can really decide wages. Everybody wants the lowest cost product, and many of those come from overseas. But in the end, we're killing ourselves. Bricks and mortar are going away. Stores like that are going away. And I don't see how Amazon and Whole Foods is good for anybody. It's certainly not good for Wegmans. So I guess I want to say that I think overall these giant mergers that are very rarely held up by the federal government are bad for democracy and bad for the marketplace and bad for wages. And with that, I'll listen to your speaker's answers offline. Thank you.
Chris, thanks for the phone call. I'm going to start with Professor Bada-Biol. I want both of our guests to respond here. Professor, I want to start with you, because one of the things you wrote about in your piece for RBJ last month is this idea that, you know, I don't think you style yourself as pro or anti-merger blanket statement per se. What you're saying is, right, in different sectors and different industries, they could have different impacts.
Right.
And that you point to some research indicating that you think for some consumers in some industries, some mergers might be potentially good.
Beneficial, right.
So here's Chris in Pittsford saying he can't look at this merger and think of any way it could be good for consumers. What do you think?
Well, I think the jury's out on that. So we are going to have to wait and see what actually happens with the acquisition. So, for instance, a lot of people I've talked to in the very brief time since the merger was announced are extremely worried about job loss as a result of automation. A lot of, you know, minimum wage or close to minimum wage cashiers losing their jobs. Now, that's one possibility. But for instance, if Amazon is able to lure more customers to Whole Foods as a result of lower prices, possibly better delivery services, then the demand for Whole Food products is going to go up. And because the demand for Whole Foods products is going to go up, and we know that Whole Foods in general has a very good relationship with locally sourced produce, the demand for this locally sourced produce might itself go up. So that's one avenue by which jobs may actually increase, not of course of cashiers, but jobs elsewhere in the economy. The other way in which jobs might increase is if Amazon is successful in making a really good deal, coming up with a really good deal for consumers as far as increasing the e-commerce portion of Whole Foods. That, again, has the potential for increasing jobs, but again, amongst programmers and computer scientists and not minimum wage workers. So when we look at jobs, it's possible that some jobs will be lost, no question, but it's also possible that some jobs will be gained. So we have to look at the net picture, even if you're looking at just jobs. But I would suggest that the more appropriate way to be looking at a merger like this is the overall picture in terms of what happens to the American economy, not just the grocery market, but consumers across the board who now shop not only at Whole Foods, but might continue to shop even after the acquisition.
And Professor, what can we suspect about wages with a job like this? And you also already pointed out Whole Foods not unionized.
Yes, it's not unionized. So we have to have a crystal ball in terms of what's going to happen to wages. I think a big portion for Amazon getting into this particular realm is to see what it can do vis-a-vis Walmart. And Amazon is an excellent experimenter. So it's going to, see and observe and collect data on shopping patterns at Whole Foods, use that data to sell more of what it observes consumers buying more of, and basically trying to figure out whether there's any effective online meaningful way of delivering groceries to consumers. That's a sector in which most people have floundered so far, and the jury's out on whether Amazon's going to succeed. So we don't know. There are both negative and positive effects to consider.
All right, Matt Stoller, go ahead.
I just want to say, everything the caller said, I agree with. I couldn't have said it better myself. In terms of jobs and wages, you can just look and see what has Amazon done in the oldest field that it's been in, and that is the book industry. The book industry is at this point a very, very, very minor part of Amazon's business. They are the major player in the book industry, so even though they are, for authors, publishers, Amazon is the 800-pound gorilla, but Amazon barely notices that entire industry. Authors, income of authors in the last 10 years has dropped by roughly 25%. That's not because reading has gone down. In fact, book sales have gone up. What's happened is Amazon. Amazon has come in, and as the middleman, has crammed down the rights of publishers and the rights of authors. It's a monopolist. It's a middleman. That's what it does. Jeff Bezos goes into industries and crams down margin and uses monopsony power to pull power into his platform. We know this. This is not a mystery. We don't need a crystal ball. We know that, Whole Foods treats farmers fairly well, and Amazon is going to come in and is going to treat them very poorly, and their income will go down. That's just it. We know that's going to happen. That is his business model.
By the way, there is not universal consensus on the idea that Whole Foods allegedly treats farmers and its local suppliers very well. I just noticed an article on Slate that argues that exactly the opposite is true, and despite the claim of Whole Foods to be an environmentally benign steward, you could argue that there are aspects of its business undertaking which are exactly the opposite.
But what about Amazon's reputation?
Amazon's reputation is that of a brutally efficient, fearsomely competitive entity that's out to basically destroy any and everything in its sight. And that is a view that is put forward by a lot of people who refuse to understand or are unable to understand that Amazon does a lot of good, and that Amazon exists in large part because it does and provides to consumers what consumers want.
Maybe this is a good time for me to thank Matt Stoller and tell our listeners my book is still available on Amazon for about $9, but you can still get it at independent local bookstores. And every time I mention Amazon, independent local bookstores beg me to mention that they are out there, and we are glad they are there. So there we go. I paid my dues there. Let me get back to your phone calls, and I'm going to grab Linda in Rochester next. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi. This discussion has been very enlightening and interesting. Just
want to
make some comments.
Oh, Linda, Linda, do me a favor here, because I lost your connection. Call back. We've got a line open. I know you waited, so please do jump, call us back, and get in there with a cleaner connection. We'll get you back on. Dan and Webster next on the phone. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, I wanted to actually thank the economics professor for saying a couple things that make sense more recently. I think he tends to sound pretty ignorant when he says things like Matt should be crying about Walmart, or that it's maybe some sort of fallacy to think big companies are only interested in maximizing profit at the expense of anything else. I think that's very clearly a mandate for any devout capitalist. But brutally efficient, I think, sounds like an apt description of their labor practices based on what I've read about what goes on and how they treat their workers in their warehouses. And I also think that, like, he's kind of spot on about Whole Foods' corporate reputation, maybe not living up to what their PR campaigns try to portray it as, because they do actually not have that good of a reputation with regarding their claims. And I just want to say that I would point to last year in July, Obama signed a federal GMO labeling bill, like S-764, which invalidated the more stringent, more popular Vermont GMO labeling law, and it also prevented any other state from passing their own labeling laws in the future, considering Obama's extensive personal and financial ties with the biotech industry and the big bad Monsanto. I think it's pretty easy to see why some people draw a connection between Whole Foods and Monsanto on some of their overlapping interests.
Dan, thanks for the phone call. Let me just kind of kick this to Professor Badabial and piggyback on one thing that Dan was saying. You know, I do not want to devolve into a GMO conversation right now. That's not what I want to do. Yes, please, don't call me about GMOs. But on the subject of GMO labeling, no matter how you feel about GMO, it is true that there has been pressure on legislatures in different states to essentially pass laws saying you cannot label things certain ways, or kind of trying to disallow what consumers might be able to understand. And some point to that is saying, look, that's what happens when you have concentrated corporate power. They try to control information. They try to control labeling. They try to control what the public is consuming. Do you agree with Dan in that?
There are aspects of that are definitely true. And we have extensive labeling requirements involving nutrition across the board in this country for a whole host of different food items. But I will say that, you know, the GMO debate, and I'll stop here because I know you don't want to talk about this, yeah, is so charged that the labeling issue has taken on a particular meaning, where the idea seems to be on the part of a lot of people that if there is no label, there is somehow an attempt to mislead us, and that if there is a label, there is something particularly unique about GMOs. That's what the label is supposed to portray, in a way that we don't have corresponding labels for other food items.
All right, Matt, do you want to weigh in on this one?
You know, sure. I mean, I don't think there are safety problems with GMOs, but I think the problem is that you have enormous concentration in that market. So you have Monsanto controlling 90%, you know, Monsanto genetics are 90% of the corn crops, 90% of the wheat crops, and you're seeing Monsanto Bayer merger, Dow, DuPont, ChemChina, Syngenta. There's massive mergers going on here, and when these companies are the only ones really financing a lot of the safety studies and controlling research into genetics, you know, we have a really serious political problem. We have a concentration problem, and that's our food system. But I want to touch on something that the professor has been kind of pushing on, and kind of agree with him on something, which is he's been sort of making the case, hey, Whole Foods, not a great actor, Walmart, you know, not a great actor, concentration of power, so on and so forth. And what I think Amazon does, and I'm not particularly, I'm concerned about Amazon because it's the most aggressive kind of part of this monopoly thrust. But it's not the only one. In fact, it is the most advanced stage of an intellectual trend which has caused, which has allowed our country to concentrate power in all sorts of ways. And what we saw in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was the rise of these mega chain stores who concentrated power in, I think, some dangerous ways, used a lot of PR, and undermined community sovereignty. And now Amazon is even worse, but it's part of the same intellectual trend. It's part of the same it's lack of enforcement of antitrust, lack of enforcement of the rights of small producers, lack of enforcement of the rights of labor. These are all a part of the same trend. Amazon is just the most aggressive, and the most dangerous version of that. So I agree with the professor that we have a lot of other dangers. I just think Amazon is sort of the most obvious, most pernicious, most malevolent, and most powerful.
You want to respond to that, Amit? Go ahead.
I agree with the first part. I'm glad that we're in agreement on something. But as far as Amazon is concerned, I have a very different perspective. Amazon's two key business avenues are its cloud activities, the web services, and e-commerce in general. And if you look at Amazon's valuation right now, it's upward of $400 billion. And from what I can see, and I can't say that I've made an exhaustive study of all top American companies, it is the only company where its valuation derives almost entirely from what investors think it is likely to be able to accomplish in the future. And a big reason why that is the case is because Jeff Bezos thinks long-term in a way that virtually no other CEO that I'm familiar with does. So the fact that he's pushing back the emphasis on very short-term issues to short-term profit generation, compensation of CEOs on the basis of short-term results to a significantly longer-term perspective, he is to be applauded. And this seems to be catching on with investors because, as I just said, right now its sales aren't a very humongous figure. They're like $16, $20 billion. It operates on wafer-thin margins, but it can afford to do so because it's a relatively big firm. But what it will actually do in the future, in the next 20 to 30 years, is where a significant part of the corporate excitement lies, and investors are betting, many betting big, that it's going to be able to pull off a virtual rabbit from the bag.
All right, I want to get back to your phone calls. Bonnie in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, hi. There's a ton of things to say about this and not enough time, but you know, generally, I think, you know, we all know what capitalism is. It's mainly about profit and often about greed. And I think to say anything that's kind of a statistical discussion that doesn't include the whole long, long, long history of the negatives of capitalism, which would take about 4 hours to talk about. And what I connect here, I agree with a lot with what the reporter was saying and a few other callers, is that you are in a situation where the whole issue of work is becoming more and more in question. And I would refer, I think this whole area needs to be linked together to the broader question of what's kind of talk behind the scenes these days is, you know, some of it's called, is there an end to work or will it be an end to work? There's a wonderful article in the Atlantic magazine of 2015, July, August, called A World Without Work by Derek Thompson, very long. And the issues that are raised in there talks about the number, the terrible loss of jobs because of automation and, you know, some of the forms of technology, some are fine, some are not. And what's happening is it seems to me it's also opening the door for what I consider these kind of male, mad, aggressive people who can justify everything they do, as your other guest has been doing. You know, it'll all turn out fine, or it probably will turn out fine, and we ought to just keep trying it. Well, in the midst of doing that, you're screwing a lot of people. You're taking a lot of risk for people that have no say in things. And one of the big groups, and I wish you would have labor more when you have these kind of discussions present, because labor is now not only not as active, but it's hardly heard anymore, which it was never heard that much before. But now, so these things, these issues that affect people's lives, because my understanding of the whole the market that's being proposed is Whole Foods, is that they're also, he's going to do it without cashiers. That was something that was documented in the write-up about this whole thing. So that's harming people, and fitting it in the bigger picture of the world of work and what that will be or won't be in the future has to be talked about now, not 20 years from now, but now, because all these things are critical in the longer run. They're not just looking at the you know, the past, but they have to look at the future, and they have tremendously dynamic effects on everything, including the social fabric. So we can't just look at this as like, well, this is just one little thing that this guy has a desire to do, and he's going to deal with the supermarket world and expand, and Amazon's going to take over everything. And I would also point out places like Uber and some others are, they figure that, all they have to do is kind of barge in and do and make up their own rules, and then later if they do something wrong, oh, we'll get your hand slapped, but we're going to just keep on doing it this way.
All right, Bunny, I got to jump in because I want our guests to have time to respond here. And I want to, first of all, thank you. And I'm going to agree with Bonnie. I think we can have labor at the table more often, and I can do better with that. So, Bonnie, thank you for that. And thank you for that nudge. Matt Stoller, I'll start with you. A lot to chew on there. Go ahead.
Right. So we have a problem where our rights as Americans are no longer honored. And this is not just an issue of unions and workers. New York Times did a story. 10% of Americans are now covered by non-compete agreements. This is not just technical workers with trade secrets. It's people like fast food workers or journalists who are given contracts saying if you leave, you're not allowed to work for a rival competitor.
Oh, I've been there. Yep.
That is a problem. We have a big problem with concentration in general. There's fewer places to work, and people have less leverage in which to sell their labor. An economist named Simcha Barkai found it because of reduced concentration in the economy over the last 30 years, corporate non-financial spending per worker has dropped by $14,000. That's $14,000 a year per non-financial worker in the American economy. That's how much they are injured because of concentrated power. And then when you get to Amazon, I mean, don't just think about it as kind of how they treat their workers, but think about it as whether you can start or run a small business, because an alternative to, working for someone else is working for yourself. And Amazon uses its power over the retail infrastructure, the Amazon marketplace, to undermine small businesses. So as one example, there was this merchant who is selling a line of pillows modeled on NFL mascots named Pillow Pets, and Amazon saw through their marketplace that sales were booming, so they put the same product for less money, and gave it featured placement on the site, and right before Christmas, and so the merchant sales collapsed. You cannot operate through Amazon's marketplace as a small business, and that is an attack on all of us as Americans, and it's part of an overall intellectual attack on our rights as Americans that are placing more and more power into the hands of a concentrated small group of people.
All right, Professor Badabiel.
So I'll just comment on three of the points, one raised by Matt and two raised by your caller. Matt is absolutely right when he talks about non-compete clauses. Those are a problem, and to that I would add the proliferation of binding arbitration clauses, where you cannot take your case to court for a particular reason, whatever the underlying reason may be, but you're often required to sign binding arbitration clauses. And those are problems. They typically hurt consumers. No question about that. As far as your caller is concerned, I think the basic point that she was making is that automation in general is just going to destroy jobs in a way that we've never seen before, and that we need to do something about the fact that job losses are taking place now, people are being hurt now. Now, you and I have talked about this issue before. I think that there will certainly be some job losses as a result of automation, no question about it.
Net job loss?
Well, net, we don't know.
Okay.
That's the big uncertainty. But I would like to point out that these issues have come up at least three or four times in the last century, and people with great minds such as John Maynard Keynes were wrong, in fact, spectacularly wrong, when he wondered about what we would do with this amazing amounts of leisure that we would have in our place, at our disposal. But the thing to point out is that in this kind of discussion, the arrival of technology and automation very, very frequently creates jobs in a way that it is difficult to foresee. So let me give you one tangible example. If you had told a person in 1905 or 1910 that his or her grandchildren would be working on video games and activities relating to being cyber sleuths, I think most of those people at that point in time would have thought you were completely crazy. So the point to understand it is that it's very easy to identify the job losses, but much harder to predict where the source of new jobs is actually going to be. And this is a conundrum that's not appreciated enough, and that's why people focus on the part that it is easily identifiable, minimum wage cashiers, for instance, but don't pay enough attention to the jobs that are likely to arise because it's difficult to foresee right now what they might be.
All right, we two guests, two very different perspectives, out of time, and I just want to thank both of them for being here. Professor Ahmed Badabiel from RIT, his piece in the RBJ last month, Are Mergers Good for Consumers? Nice to have you. Thank you for being here, Ahmed.
Thanks for having me.
And Matt Stoller, who is wrote a piece for Huffington Post about America's Amazon problem. He's a fellow at the Open Markets Program at the New America Foundation, among other things. And Matt, generous with your time. Thank you for taking the time for the program today. All right, that's Matt Stoller, Ahmed Badabiel, Rob Braden, the engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get a break, and we've got more Connections coming up.